This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Welcome, everyone. We are on the set of Miss Juliet. I've been asked to tell you, probably know that. You've probably been to it. It's designed by Alice Babbage, and the play is directed by Kip Williams, although not today. We are going to have a 45-minute discussion and then 15 minutes of questions from the audience. And when it comes to question time, there are microphones at each of the doors, so if you want to ask questions, head in that direction. I've also been asked to mention that at the end of the session there will be a book signing in the foyer, and I've been asked to do what the Wheeler Centre traditionally does, which is to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, to acknowledge that this is the traditional land of the Kulin Nation, and to pay our respects to their elders past and present, and to the elders of any other Indigenous community who may be present. That's the orthodox acknowledgement, but if I may add an unorthodox acknowledgement, which I've not checked with management, I would like to acknowledge that we took the land from them. And as if to add insult to injury, we took their children from them, and we have not yet devised any rational plan for making good the damage which we caused, damage which caused a society which had survived successfully for 50,000 years to fall into hopelessness and despair after just 200 years of white occupation of their land. Now, David Hare.
I have absolutely nothing to add.
Oh, well, actually, what you could have added, I suppose, if you'd got over jet lag and had tuned into current Australian politics, that in 1788, there was that year, I think, the largest arrival of uninvited people by boat. And curiously, Aborigines tend to be rather supportive of modern boat people, whereas we, the white settlers who took the place from them, tend not to be. I did want to start, though, by mentioning that you were born at St Leonard's, close to Bexhill, and then when you were five, you moved to Bexhill and later studied at Lancing College?
That's right.
Lancing College.
Yeah.
Which you greatly enjoyed, I understand.
Well, only because it wasn't Bexhill. And, you know, I've written a book which is really a memoir of my first 30 years of my life. And I was born in the sort of unnaturally boring town of near Hastings. And it was just deadly, absolutely deadly, both in its post-war sense of post-war trauma. In other words, I was born having just missed some major event which had traumatized everybody, but which I could not understand why everyone was in this state of extraordinary coma. The words nice and quiet were joined at the hip. They were synonymous. And, of course, I wanted noise, excitement, glamour, all these things. But on the other hand, a provincial, you know, lower middle class, semi-detached background is great for a writer. And it's the natural breeding ground of a writer.
But as I understand it from Bexhill, in earlier times, you would have been able to hear the sounds of war during the First War. And so nice and quiet makes some sense.
Yes. Well, Virginia Woolf and Bernard Shaw both record sitting in the garden in their quiet house in Sussex, and from across the channel they could hear the sounds of the trenches and the conflict in the trenches. So there was this extraordinary sense of the war coming across. And what you were just asking me about, the sense of the European Union and why the British want to leave the European Union, I think if you're born in Sussex, you have a very strong sense of the continent, because you've always sensed that only 20 miles away is this absolutely fascinating place. And again, being born in a very boring place, as I was, all I dreamt of was getting... You know, when we first had a family holiday in a minor town in Belgium, I just thought it was incredibly romantic. And I've gone on thinking anywhere that isn't Bexhill is very romantic. Mm.
And dreams of leaving, I guess.
Yeah, dreams of leaving have motivated my whole life.
Yes. Now, after doing well at Lancing College, you went to Cambridge, which was then under the spell of F.R. Leavis.
Very much so.
And I gather you didn't appreciate that.
No, there was a... the thing was that when I was a scholarship boy and I was sort of forced up through the English class system. Mm. And at my school, I was lucky enough to have inspirational teachers who really taught me to celebrate literature and taught me everything that was wonderful about literature. When you go to Cambridge University in those days, then the study of literature was just various old men telling you in what ways literature had disappointed them during their lives. this work failed to do that, this work failed to do that, this work, you know, so-and-so tries, but on the other hand, everyone can see he, she doesn't succeed at this. And F.R. Leavis had written a famous book called The Great Tradition, in which he had enumerated the writers who met with his hard-won approval. I think there were five in human history who actually came, and most of them were called Eliot. They were either called they were called George Eliot, or they were called T.S. Eliot, or they were called Eliot this or Eliot that. You sort of had to be called Eliot.
Dickens got in with one book, didn't he?
There was only one book of Dickens's that was approved at Cambridge. He was said to lack the formal control of a great novelist, is what Leavis said about him. And so you could see that actually what was being taught was not literature, but resentment against literature. And that was about a creative, critical divide that seemed to me absolute. In other words, it seemed to me there were people whose profession was literature, dealing with it as you might deal with it in a marketplace. But it left me, and I was being trained in the sort of guerrilla corps to join the elite of British literary critics. That's what I was trained to do by studying English. And it left me very much wanting to jump the fence. There's a wonderful quote of Ted Hughes, which I have in the book, which is, he says, you could only escape Cambridge as a creative artist by crawling out under the wire and avoiding the gun towers. And that's it. Everything was deprecated. Everything was put down. Everything was said to be no good. Everything was rubbish. And that, I must say, I came out of Cambridge with that longing never to be a critic.
Although, of course, what he said was accurate in a different way, because the gates were locked at midnight, as I understand it.
Oh, yeah.
And people would have to climb back in over the walls, and every now and then people would fall to the ground and die.
The reason I wrote the book is that I wrote a play set in my school in 1960-65.
At South Downs.
It was called South Downs. And when I was explaining this play to teenage boys now who were playing the parts, I realised that it was the culture I was describing was closer to Victorian England than it was to the present day. It was so arcane that teenagers would just say now, but how can life have been like that? It seems extreme. My parents brought me up to believe that because I had missed the main event, the Second World War, therefore, people of my age, our lives had been very uninteresting. It was only when I wrote this play set in the 60s that I realized how far we'd traveled since the 1960s, and I wanted to write about how completely the culture had changed in those 50 or 60 years.
You write in the book, that I can recommend the book, by the way. It's really very good. although I did learn some things about you from other places as well. You write in the book that you learned to fake a confidence you didn't feel.
Yes.
In your schooling at Lancing College.
Well, I could see that the only way to survive was to pretend that you were more secure than you were. And so most people from my background are deeply insecure.
Yeah.
And so it has been necessary in my life to pretend that I'm better armoured than I am. But then when I write about this, this is something that most people recognise. And one of the reasons I think people respond to the book is because I'm truthful about that.
Mm. Yeah, certainly you reveal in a number of places how insecure you feel or felt, and your sense of self-hatred.
Yeah, I think self-hatred is a powerful motivator in my life, and for many, many years it was the motor of more or less everything that I did and felt. People who are strangers to self-hatred and who've never experienced it think that the book is affected in some way and say, oh, surely you can't have disliked yourself as much as that. To which I just feel, if you have never known self-dislike, good for you, chum. I mean, I'm sure you've lived a very happy life. But most of us, at some point, have known the weaknesses and the profound failings of our own character and been very, very unhappy about them. And I've tried to write truthfully about that.
I was going to come to this later, but you remind me that in the book you quote something that Ronald Bryden wrote, a critic, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wrote, "All the same, it is the personal tensions in his talent, your talent, the tug between popularity and politics, display and distaste for his own cleverness, which have made Teeth and Smiles, for all its impurities, a success." So...
Yeah, I had a very difficult time because when I started writing plays, they were quite successful. And this is very much disapproved of on the left, you know. I mean, I was brought up at the Royal Court Theatre, and a basic principle of the Royal Court Theatre was that anything that succeeded was suspect, and anything that failed was good. And that we really believed in, and it wasn't a bad way of looking at the world. And it actually, with the history of the Royal Court Theatre, and I talk about in the book, the four seminal works of post-war theatre were all badly received when they came out. In other words, Waiting for Godot was regarded as ridiculous. The Birthday Party closed in a week. Look Back in Anger had a couple of very powerful advocates, but was generally not taken seriously. And then Saved, which was the play I was around for at the Royal Court Theatre, was absolutely vilified and led to the abolition of the Lord Chamberlain and censorship in the theatre because of various powerful people advocating it. But when it was on at our theatre, the Royal Court Theatre, it played to 25%. That's what Saved by Edward Bond, which is now regarded as the great modern classic, played to. So to us, it was axiomatic that anything that was good was way ahead of public taste. Now, that is no longer the way in the subsidised theatre. In other words, in the subsidised theatre in Britain now works by the same criteria as the commercial theatre, which is the expectation that if something is hugely popular, it must therefore also be excellent. So the whole notion of the avant-garde, of the cutting edge, and the cutting edge which is in advance of public taste, no longer exists in England.
That's not limited to England, I think.
I can't speak to that.
No. It's interesting you mention those because your play, Plenty,
yeah,
and also The Judas Kiss,
yeah,
had a similar fate, didn't they? With, yeah. That is to say, unpopular at first, but at least in relation to Plenty, the theatre held on and held on, and it became a runaway success.
Yes, I mean, you know, you have to understand that I was born at a time of an intense culture war. Now, I'm happy to say, maybe it's better for them, maybe it's worse. When young writers write their first play, then in British newspapers, they're given 3 stars, and the critic says it's jolly good, of course it's not as good as so-and-so, so-and-so, but on the other hand, it's not bad, good luck, I hope your next one's better. You know, there's a generally benign attitude to young writers. They're encouraged, and young writing is thought to be a good thing, of which all, well, you know, good, well-minded people think well. They wanted to kill us at birth. They really wanted to strangle us, and they didn't even want to let us get out of the delivery room. Because the threat we represented to the critics and to some of the audiences was that we wanted to make the theatre a place where politics and social things could be discussed. We wanted to make it grown up, whereas they loved their theatre, decorative, amusing, light evening out. And so we were horrible, nasty, hairy, anarchic anarchists who were coming along to spoil their art form. And they set to war to destroy us. And that war really marked me as a person. It took a tremendous toll on me, which I tried to describe in the book. And it also took a tremendous toll on anyone who was close to me, my family.
Well, that war was one in which you were a combatant, not from birth, but from the time of leaving Cambridge and setting up the portable theatre. So perhaps, I don't know whether people in the audience know about the Portable Theatre.
In 1960...
The punk of theatre, really, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, in 1968, we simply wrote to Volkswagen, who'd never been written to before, by people asking for a free van. And they gave us a free van because nobody had ever written to them asking for a free van. And we wrote to Olympia and were given a free typewriter. And we started a theatre company which would simply present short, nasty, unpleasant, aggressive plays, which were brutal, usually lasted 60, 70 or 80 minutes, and then we left town having
before you were told to.
Having upset everybody as thoroughly as possible. And we would do these plays anywhere. We'd do them in prisons, we'd do them on canteen floors, we'd do them in people's houses, we'd do them in village halls, we'd do them anywhere we were invited to. And they were artistically very crude. You'd sling up some lights, you'd do the play and get out. But there was an excitement about it, obviously, which was to try and attract a completely new audience and to also say new things. We thought that theatre was dogged by the problem of aesthetics. That, in other words, people go to the play Hamlet not in order to decide whether to be or not to be. In other words, very few people come out of a production of Hamlet deciding to kill themselves on the basis of what they've seen. They're more likely to come out of it saying, well, he wasn't as good as
or
Benedict.
Or kill their stepfather.
Well, they're more likely to say, well, he wasn't as good as Benedict Cumberbatch, or he's not as good as David Tennant, or I prefer Geoffrey Rush, or, you know, in other words, it's aesthetics that the bulk of the theatre audience goes for. They go for the, this is a good Miss Julie, this is a bad Miss Julie, it's not as good as when I saw it before. It's all about an aesthetic experience, not about what the play is actually saying. So we thought, how can we get round that problem? And that's by crashing the problem of aesthetics. It's just saying, we're not going to do this very well, there won't be much of a set, we'll just sling up some lights and we'll come and do it near where you live. And you will then perhaps listen to what we say rather than the manner in which we say it.
Now, the we that you refer to was you, Snoo Wilson and Howard Brenton.
Yeah.
And your role was primarily as director.
Yeah.
Until Snoo Wilson let you down with a play that he was supposed to deliver on for the following Monday.
That's
and
right.
I think it came to Wednesday before and he hadn't written it.
That's right.
Because he had exams to do.
He only let us know on a Wednesday
yeah.
that he regarded getting his degree more important than writing his play for our theatre.
Offending Bex Hill.
Yeah. A real failure of nerve, we felt. And so between Wednesday and Monday, I turned and became a writer, and I wrote a play, a one-act play, in 4 days, which was predictably terrible. But when I handed the pages to the actors, they did not seem unhappy. In other words, they looked at the dialogue, and you could tell that they thought, oh, okay, I can say this and not sound like a complete lemon. And so I realized I had a gift that I didn't know I had, which was a gift for writing dialogue. But that was very far from discovering that I also had a gift for writing plays. And a gift for writing dialogue is a sort of sine qua non. You've got to have it. But on the other hand, it's only the first step towards writing a play.
And you later, of course, you were involved in setting up Joint Stock.
Yeah.
And then later you were invited to be part of the National Theatre.
Yeah.
And that led to all sorts of political controversies amongst you and your colleagues.
Yeah, there was a very peculiar thing that the National Theatre movement in Britain was essentially came out of Bernard Shaw and Harley Granville Barker at the turn of the 19th to 20th century. And it was about removing the art form from the pressures of commerce. That's what it was for. It said, hold on, theatre is an art form, and yet it is an art form which in Britain has traditionally been in the hands of private managers, and it has had to be a commercial form. And we want to create an art theatre, and the only way we can create an art theatre in Britain is by having a national theatre. And that was the impulse that created it. So it always came from radicals and liberals and from the left. But by the time it came to be realised in the 60s and 70s, there was a fringe theatre movement that was saying, hang on, if there's a national theatre, it's going to be an establishment theatre. And we don't want anything to do with an establishment theatre, and the national theatre is going to be the enemy of radical theatre. Whereas people like Howard Brenton and I were saying, well, it's only going to be an establishment theatre if it's handed to establishment writers and directors. And do you really think you're so weak and your ideas are so weak that you fear to take the nation's biggest and most prominent stages, why would you want to hand them over to all the people who didn't believe in a national theatre in advance? We're the people who did believe in it. So people like Howard Brenton and I, who leapt at the opportunity to work at a national theatre, became politically incredibly unpopular in the left in England because we were said to be betraying something. And what we were betraying was the purity of the ideals of the left. But I'd already lived through the purity argument. I'd lived through the purity argument in literature. In other words, at Cambridge, I'd lived through the, quote, purity argument about, you know, there's only four good writers. Now, apparently, there was only one good way of being virtuous, and that was to be outside the big theatres. And I think purity is a big problem on the left, and it doesn't normally help the left very much, that attitude that only one way is right.
You do seem to be somewhat critical of both left and right from time to time, depending on circumstances. I completely understand that, by the way. But I noted somewhere you had said that if people on the right had shitty attitudes, people on the left sometimes behaved in shitty ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's been my experience.
Do you want to enlarge on that?
I suppose what I'm saying is that I'm long past the age at which I type people by their political attitudes. In other words, I've met virtuous peoples on the right whose instincts are generous and well-meaning, and I've met some very dodgy people on the left whose instincts are very far from that. But it's true that the tiresome thing about being a playwright is the permanent need to defend your own work. And I suppose, as I say in the book, you don't necessarily have much control over what you write. What you write comes from your imagination. It's not polemic. It's not, as it were, an article. It's not a piece of reason. It's something that you either like or dislike according to what your imagination tells you. And in that way, a political playwright is no different from any other kind of playwright. The idea is we're thought of in the theatre as being what I call short-order cooks. In other words, producers come to us, political writers, and say, can you do me a play about this? Can you do me a play about that? You know, you're the political writer. You must be writing about this. This is the most important issue of the day. You write about that. And it's very hard to explain to them that your affinity with subject matter is just the same as for any other artist. You can write, after I'd written about the Chinese Revolution, people came to me and said, can you please now write about the Russian Revolution? And I can't explain why I want to write about the Chinese Revolution, but I don't want to write about the Russian Revolution any more than Francis Bacon can explain why he wants to paint the Pope, but he doesn't want to paint the Archbishop of Canterbury. He can't explain that to you, because your subject matter chooses you. Mm. You don't choose your subject matter.
And so you
find yourself all the time defending the choices you make, but actually the choices you make are being made by your imagination. You're not making them.
And yet your work on the Chinese Revolution was your adaptation of Fan Shen, a book by Hinton, which was essentially a book written from the right-wing position.
No.
Hinton
was a tractor technician.
Your position, your position and his were opposite.
My position and his were opposite. Hinton was a tractor technician who was sent by the Americans to help with the agrarian revolution, and then he lived through the Maoist revolution. And he was wholly 100% behind that revolution. Now, even by 1975, whenever I wrote Fan Shen, it was clear that Mao had not been an unmixed blessing for the Chinese people. And so I wrote it much more as a classical play. And that resulted in a certain argument between us, because he was a Marxist and I wasn't. Mm.
And you had a long meeting with him.
A long negotiation where we made 150 changes in the play at his request. His daughter was a Red Guard. So she was telling him exactly what was wrong with the play, politically. But I've spent my life in those kind of negotiations and under that kind of criticism. Because the problem is, if you want the theatre to be political, you assume a huge importance in people's minds, and they want you to be expressing not what you feel and not what your imagination tells them to, but what they feel. They want this to be the play on the subject. So if I'm the person who writes the play about the diplomatic process leading up to the war in Iraq, everyone wants to tell me what's wrong with the play because it doesn't quite agree with what they think. But I can't satisfy everybody in that way.
And there are critics that you can't satisfy. I discovered outside your book, you don't actually quote this. What's the fellow's name? Farndale. Farndale, who writes for the Daily Telegraph. Probably not part of your daily reading. Farndale wrote some fairly unpleasant things, which I'm sure you've picked up on, haven't you?
Not till this very moment.
Oh dear. Oh, well, I'm sorry. Well, Farndale wrote, and this was on in the Daily Telegraph on the 4th of June 2011, so if you'd seen it the next day, it would have been a very unhappy birthday for you. He refers to you as a right...
It's very kind of you to bring me up today.
Look, I won't if you like. It's okay. He said, David Hare's political judgment has failed him again. The playwright's claim that the arts are becoming more right-wing must be some sort of wind-up. And he goes on to say, I'd be surprised if this were the case, given that the arts in this country are pretty much a left-wing hegemony and have been since the arrival of the angry young men in the mid to late 50s.
Well, that's not nearly as unpleasant as I was expecting.
So David himself can't exactly complain...
Here it comes.
..about being held back by his politics. He started out doing agitprop theatre in the late 60s, has more or less been a permanent fixture at the National Theatre since the late 70s, and despite his knighthood, big house in Hampstead, and champagne socialist lifestyle...
Right.
..is pretty much an unreconstructed leftist, possibly a Marxist, though that might be unfair to him and to Marx.
Well, it's lovely, isn't it?
It's interestingly written, but I assumed that if you had seen it, you would not have agreed with most of that.
No.
So what about his argument that that the theatre in Britain has been a left-wing hegemony since the arrival of the angry young men? I mean, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, this is an argument that you hear a lot, which is why are there no right-wing playwrights? And to which the answer is there are many extremely distinguished right-wing playwrights. Tom Stoppard is the obvious example of someone who calls himself not a conservative with a big C, but he calls himself a small C conservative. And he's a libertarian, and he's fought incredibly hard and incredibly nobly for freedom of speech from a principled right-wing point of view, and is something of a hero for what he has done on behalf of freedom of speech. And he's also a principled anti-communist, you know, who in the bad years of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc was writing against what was happening in those countries. And so it simply isn't true. But I think it's simply a reflection of other art forms and the media generally in Britain, which is that we have obviously an extremely right-wing press for all the obvious colonial reasons. And we also have, you know, the novel, by and large, literature in the establishment sense has not been very political or social in the kind of writers that it's produced in Britain. And it's been the theatre which has been the means by which society has talked about itself, and television now to a degree also. And remember, we all wrote for television in the 60s and 70s, in the 1970s, because we could write about the society at large. And so, yeah, probably we do seem very left-wing compared to the common wisdom in the Daily Telegraph, is it?
And depending on where the centre has moved to from time
exactly.
to time.
That's exactly that.
Now, you refer to Stoppard, and it's interesting because Tom Stoppard, whose output of plays is quite slow, once expressed the concern that he would need to write another play soon because in his passport he's described as a playwright, and he's worried that if he doesn't produce one, they'll take his passport off him. Now, I wondered, thinking about that, how you're described in your passport, because you've been a playwright, a screenwriter, a director. How are you describing
it? A playwright.
Right.
I mean, I wish I had been a filmmaker. In other words, I made three films in the 1980s, and each one was worse than the one before. And I think that is a common pattern. In other words, I think that when directors make their first film, it's usually great, because they've waited so long to make it that you make it out of a kind of innocence and urgency, and this is the film you desperately want to make. And you don't actually know how hard filmmaking is. I've described before that I think most film directors' careers are U-shaped, or some are L-shaped. They're either but the U is you start at the top and you go down to the bottom, and then if you've got fortitude, you climb back up again, and you climb up the other side. And if you start, and I'm sure everybody's running directors through in their minds as I speak, but it is true that you slowly realise how incredibly difficult it is. When you don't know how difficult it is, you can make a good film. Once you realise how difficult it is, you have to relearn and learn. And because I made three, each one of which was worse, I decided to stop at that point and never directed again until I did the Waraker trilogy with Bill Nye, the three films, which I had the confidence again to direct film again.
Mm. Although you have done the screenplays for a number of
loads.
Things, which is very close to filmmaking, I suppose.
Yeah.
Would you describe yourself as a writer generally, rather than just a playwright?
Well, I'm a screenwriter, but I think probably the way I put it is that my collaborative gene is beginning to die on me, I think. I just don't think I can attend many more script meetings. I just don't think I can get through them, you know? Not without Class A drugs.
Yes.
I just cannot sit and listen again to Wouldn't It Be Better If? And, you know, I've spent my whole life in collaboration, and I've loved spending a life in collaboration, and particularly I've enjoyed the collaboration with actors, and I love the scrutiny that a play is put under by actors, and I adore working with them, and I adore the realization of what I want through the means of loads of other people contributing to it. But I do find sitting in small rooms with producers harder and harder as the years go by, and my temper is very frayed. I'm not temperamentally suited to it anymore.
Going back to the time when you were temperamentally suited
to it... I mean, just to finish on that, with the film The Reader, which was a bit of a watershed for me, I calculated at the end of it that I had spent 10 times more doing what you do for a living, which is lawyering on behalf of my script, that I had writing my script. In other words, the actual writing of the script had taken me a couple of months, but I had then spent up to a couple of years defending my script against the processes of the filmmaking. And so what I was not doing was writing, but speaking on behalf of my writing. Mm. And I do find that proportion now in filmmaking is killing. That the idea that from beginning to end you have to be defending what your idea was. The film, The Reader, ended up pretty much what I wrote, but only after 2 years of intense, ceaseless babble and articulation.
Well, that, it occurred to me, must have been particularly difficult because Bernhard Schlink is very ambiguous in... The book is very ambiguous about whether he had experienced the things that are the subject of the book. Did that cause any difficulties?
No, I mean, I just took it as a given that Bernhard Schlink
was
never going to tell me whether it was true or not.
Yeah.
And those of you who know the book, The Reader, but the special problem of The Reader, which I, from the very beginning, said, is that it's written as if it were an autobiographical book, and so it is as if the person who is the hero of the book, played by Ralph Fiennes in our film, is writing it down. And from the very beginning, I said to Stephen Daldry, this cannot work because nobody believes that Stephen Daldry is the author of the film. Nobody believes that I am the author of the film. We have to invent another figure. So I invented a framework whereby he revealed the events to his daughter. And from the very first day, the producers, both of whom tragically died in the course of the film, Anthony Minghella was one, Sidney Pollack was the other, Anthony Minghella said to me, well, you can have this framework, but it will fall away. It will never work. And I kept saying, the framework is the best thing about the film, and it will be there on the day the film opens. And it was there on the day the film opens, but for 2 years, I defended that framework. And so it's that becomes exhausting, you know?
The collaboration you spoke of before was perhaps exemplified in a discussion you had, and I think, I can't remember from the book when it was, but you were told, whatever you do, don't spill the sacrament.
Yeah.
An essential lesson in the collaborative effort.
It was a wonderful thing. I was directing very badly, and I was saying to the actor, oh, yes, and what's so marvellous about what you're doing there, and, you know, it's so great what you're doing there. And when I described to the actor what it was the actor was doing, the actor said to me, David, don't spill the sacrament. And it was just the greatest thing that's ever been said to me as a director. And I thought, yeah, I believe in the mystery of what I do. What am I doing trampling all over the mystery of what actors do? The actor so much more eloquently could convey it. Why did I need to describe it? And so directing that just consists of sort of thermostating what the actor's doing and putting what the actor's doing into prose isn't directing. Directing's much more proper directing, and I've been lucky enough to work with some great directors. Proper directing is feeding that actor and giving that actor more possibility that they can make the sacrament even more interesting. But it isn't diminishing the sacrament by seeking to describe it, you know.
Mm. Given that we are meeting in Melbourne, the Pravda is an interesting play that you wrote about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Pravda? And the genesis of it.
The genesis of it? Well, I think the genesis of it is that Howard Brenton and I wanted to write a play about Rupert Murdoch. I don't think
it's taken a long time to actually come clean and say that directly.
I think I now say that. Yeah. I do say that. We were very worried about legal problems.
Mm.
And we wrote a play about a megalomaniacal press proprietor. And the National Theatre insisted that it be read by lawyers, people in your profession, a QC, which at the time cost £5,000, which I thought was a scandalous waste of public money. But actually, the QC said this wonderful thing, and he said, this play appears to be a portrait of a man utterly without morality, who has absolutely no concern for the public good, and who can only find sexual satisfaction in the act of sacking people. Now, if Rupert Murdoch wants to step forward and identify himself as... as the hero of this play, that's up. Good luck to him, is what he said.
Interestingly, and only a Melbourne audience would recognise this, but that was the tack taken in The Defence of Power Without Glory, because the John West of the book, who was thought to be John Wren, John Wren could only sue if he came forward and identified himself as that person, and all of the witnesses who came forward and gave evidence for John Wren were asked whether they thought that he would do this and this and this and this and this, and they all said no. which I guess, I think Rupert Murdoch must have known about that.
Well, he certainly, it brought out probably one of the greatest theatre performances I've ever seen in my lifetime, which was Anthony Hopkins played Rupert Murdoch, and anybody who ever saw that performance has absolutely never forgotten it. It was just a magical performance. And it was in the Olivier Theatre, which is a sort of 1,200 seat theatre. And then for some reason that I never understand, about 6 months after the play closed, Rupert Murdoch chose to hire the Olivier Theatre in order to address 1,200 advertising executives about the advantages of advertising in the Times and the Sun. And he walked out onto the Olivier stage, and almost everybody had the same reaction, which is, he's so much less interesting than Tony Hopkins.
Now, you've done a lot of your writing during the Margaret Thatcher years, which sounded as though they were not happy years.
Well, I think, as I say in the book, I described the 30 years in which there was some sort of consensus after the war, and the post-war consensus was that whether you were on the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, society was heading in one direction, which was towards social security, a national health service, an educational system, freeing up social mobility, a greater degree of ability to climb up in the society. And obviously, the understanding was that anyone who worked in public service was working for the good, and anyone who worked for the state was working for the good, because there was that was the principle of the society. And obviously in 1979, society set off in completely the opposite direction, whereby only entrepreneurs were admired or praised, and everyone who worked in public service must be a loser and somebody who must be totally incompetent, in permanent need of what we now have, which is near Maoist revolution by conservatives who are constantly fiddling with the National Health Service, the education system, Social Security, all of which they say are incompetently run next to business, which is magically well run. And so why can't you know, the public sector be run more like the private sector has been the mantra for the last 30 years, which is why the public sector is now on its knees. And so, you know, obviously when society took that turn and when capitalism regenerated itself from within by deregulating, essentially, because that was happening with Reagan in America as it was happening with Thatcher in Britain, society took a direction which none of us had predicted. None of us saw that coming. None of us thought that would be the next stage. And so as a writer, I was left, as Nigel Farndale would say in The Telegraph, looking like a complete idiot. I was politically wrong. In other words, in the 70s, I thought we were heading for some kind of social breakdown. But far from it, we were heading for a right-wing revolution, which was something none of us had seen coming. So I found writing very, very difficult for a while. And because, you know, I was spectacularly wrong.
That's right. You say that you thought that the world would turn left after Thatcher and it turned right instead.
Yeah, before Thatcher, yeah.
But you spent your writing career under, I think, 4 Labour governments and 4 Conservative governments,
yeah.
Possibly 5 Conservative governments if we start you at Sir Alec Douglas Hume. So
I bet that word has never been said in here before. We say it again, Sir Alec Douglas Hume.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think he was probably in charge when you started writing.
No, I was born under Attlee, which was the greatest government, or said to be the greatest government of the 20th century.
Yeah. Attlee was described by Churchill, wasn't he, as would have been an adequate mayor of Birmingham in a lean year.
Yeah, so all he did was start the National Health Service and Social Security and build however many houses and now looks utopian.
Yeah, but in any event, your career has covered an almost equal number of years of governments of both different descriptions. That's probably the most neutral way of putting it. Which would you prefer right now? I mean, leave aside the present incumbent.
Oh, I personally believe there's a terrible crisis in conservatism in Britain. I think it's at the point... I'm alone in this. In other words, I've written this recently in The Guardian and received however many, bleeps and tweets that you get. But I think that conservatism is having a terrible crisis because it sort of doesn't make sense in England anymore because half of it is free market. And if you believe in free markets, then you believe in free movement of labour, and obviously... you know a lot about this, and therefore it means that you allow immigration, and at the moment, you know, we have exemplary capitalists from Syria and Libya trying to get into our country, and yet the other side of conservatism is the conservatism that wants to put walls up and try and keep everybody out. And so the actual philosophy of free market conservatism is in some sort of existential crisis that is... I don't want to go into immense detail because it will take too long, but the 2008 financial crisis was also an illustration of that. The idea that there was anything, such a thing as a free transaction in a free market, was blown out of the water. All the people who suffered from the so-called free transactions in the free markets were innocent bystanders. The people who suffered had nothing to do with the transactions. So the idea that you can have a transaction in a market and it doesn't affect anybody outside that market was shown for the lie that it is. Free market capitalism is now in the state of total discredit that Stalinism once was. And yet, for some reason, the Western world is finding it absolutely impossible to catch up with this revelation. And so it is not much that the right says in Britain makes sense, because half the time, as in trying to leave the EU, they're trying to throw up more walls and to trade in a smaller and smaller place. And yet their ideology, theoretically, is meant to be about knocking walls down. So I just don't understand modern conservatism, and I don't understand how they can look themselves in their mirror in the morning, except as just saying, well, we're operators and we're making the system work. But really, that's all it is. It's just people minding the store while they don't know in what direction they're going.
We're about to turn to questions, so if anyone wants to ask questions, you should find the microphone on Mothera. And whilst people find their way to the microphones, does what you've just said make you want Blair to come back?
No. No, I mean, the problem we have had on the left, obviously, is that Blair was the person who said power, power at all costs. It doesn't matter. Power is the only thing that the left needs, and we will, you know, you can live on a diet of power. And obviously, he took the country in a direction in the invasion of Iraq from which I don't think the country has really recovered. I think a lot of our distrust of politics in Britain, distrust of politicians, came about either, according to your point of view, because he was dishonest, or, according to your point of view, he was incredibly gullible about, plainly evidence that would not have passed your forensic tests by which he made his decisions. And this has created a huge crisis in Britain from which I don't think the Labour Party has really recovered.
Stuff happens, and an absence of war are both plays in which English Labour politicians don't come out too well.
Well, I don't think that's true of the absence of war. The absence of war was based on Neil Kinnock, who was, if you like, the last really principled and... No, that's not fair, actually, but he certainly was a principled Labour leader who basically had to betray what he believed in order to try and get himself elected, and then in the process failed to get himself elected. So I regarded Neil Kinnock as a really tragic figure, and he was a man for whom I had immense respect and sympathy. In other words, I thought that he did everything he possibly could with the cards that he was dealt, and he behaved with incredible dignity in the circumstances. Because as he said, that election, the 1992 election, and he himself said this, was really a referendum on him. And he said, the British people looked me in the eye and 30 million people decided that I wasn't up to being Prime Minister. And to say that about yourself and to know that judgment has been passed on you, if like me you're a playwright and you watch your plays fail in front of 500 people or 300 people or 600 people, I cannot imagine what it is like to know that you have lost a direction, an election which you were there to win, and the only reason it's been lost is because people have passed a negative judgment on your character. I mean, and to own up to that, as he does, I think is just noble.
On the other hand, it starts from the proposition that he was dealt bad cards, so he has to cheat by...
He doesn't have to cheat,
but
he
compromising had to tack his to principles.
He had to tack to the right. Hmm. And it is true that Tony Blair, the only conversation that I ever had with Tony Blair about this play, The Absence of War, he said to me, this play, The Absence of War, plays in my mind all the time. I think about it all the time. For me, it's a nightmare, and I never want to get into that nightmare. And I started an unfortunate sentence, which he finished for me. And I said, yeah, but it's different for you because Neil really had to sacrifice everything he believed in order to take the course he did. And then I got as far as the words, whereas you. And then he finished the sentence for me, and Blair said, I never believed in anything in the first place. And I said, I didn't say that. Hmm. But it was kind of him to finish my sentence.
And it saved a lot of lawyers a lot of trouble. But still, in the play, you have him telling a direct lie on television when asked a direct question about their policies.
Yes.
It's difficult to see direct lying in a politician as a reflection of a noble character.
He felt that it was necessary. Neil did have a plan that he, you know, the left in Britain is so distrusted on the economy that they cannot. You know, there's a line in the play which always gets a big laugh, where the person who's running the election campaign says to the leader, you can do absolutely anything in this campaign except remind people that when you're elected, you're going to be in charge of the economy. Because that's where they don't trust you at all. So Neil did his best to deal with that problem, but it is a problem that the left is not trusted on the economy.
And in the play, you also point out that unless times are easy, when times get difficult, everyone runs to Nanny.
Yeah, people vote left because they believe they can afford to vote left. Mm. They don't ever vote left because they believe that left is the answer to their economic problems. And that, obviously, is the challenge that the left in the world faces now at this moment all over the world. And it's why someone who's called a socialist, I mean, I would never have thought, and I describe in the book going to America when I was 17, the idea that there is now someone standing as a socialist, Bernie Sanders, calling himself a socialist in America and getting 30 or 40% of the Democratic caucus votes. You know, if you were called a socialist when I first went to America, you would have been run out of the country. It's unimaginable. So things are changing in quite interesting ways.
Now, has anyone got a question that they would like to ask? If you do, make your way to either of the microphones at either of the exits. But since you mentioned going to America, when you were in America, you became great friends with Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
And you have referred somewhere to the fact that having dinner with a playwright is not necessarily an enjoyable experience.
No, I don't say that. I say that it was absolutely clear when I met playwrights for the first time that they were a very ornery lot. So that an evening with John Osborne or Harold Pinter or Dennis Potter or David Mercer or Tennessee to a degree also could be an extremely bumpy occasion. There was no point at which you would not suddenly hear them get up from the table and say, I'm not having any more of this, I'm sick to death of this, I can't say, you know, and all this. And it made me realise that most playwrights were very, very angry, and I'm pretty angry myself. And the reason they're angry is because it is incredibly exposing. You put a play on a stage in front of 400 or 500 people, and you hear it fail, and you realise that people don't like you and don't like what you write. It isn't great for the character. It feels like the skin is being stripped off. And so there was also, in many playwrights' lives, a characteristic pattern, which is they arrive in the theatre, are acclaimed, they have 5 or 10 great years, and then Tennessee Williams's conversation, by the time I knew him in the 70s and 80s, was entirely about how completely forgotten he was and how his plays were no longer produced.
Yep, those bastards in New York won't put on his plays.
If you now told Tennessee the universal respect and adoration that is lavished on his work throughout the world, he would be absolutely astonished. He died believing that his plays were going to be forgotten. And it's tragic. John Osborne died in the same way. And it's terrible to watch, and it's very, very uncomfortable to be with.
And before we go to the question over here, you made a point at some stage that a novelist might say, oh, I saw someone reading my new novel in the train today.
That's
whereas
right.
You can sit in an audience and know by every movement and every sound how your play is working for them.
Yeah, and I always sit next to the person who hates it most. That is, they have that seat reserved for me. And the best one, which I do quote in the book, which I absolutely loved, was that my second play I left and I saw a woman very tenderly put her arm round her husband and she said, I'm sorry, darling, that was my idea. And these things do take a toll, you know. By the time you've heard that many times. And I also had one where I was sitting behind a couple and they turned and one said, what do you think? And the other said, if I was on television, I'd turn it off. And by the time you've heard so many of those, no wonder you're a little ornery, you know.
Yes.
You mentioned the ability to write dialogue as one important aspect of being a playwright. What do you think are the other attributes that make a dramatist?
Curiosity, really. I think that's what I meant. I was surprised when everyone laughed when I said that a provincial childhood was the ideal background, because I think it is. In other words, I was taken aback by that reaction, because a provincial childhood means that you are sort of fascinated by the world and think that the world is intrinsically interesting. And so you love finding out. A lot of what I've done has involved research, be it about the Chinese Revolution, aid to the Third World, the financial crisis, the Iraq, the police. I've spent time with the police, I've spent time with lawyers, I've spent time in prisons, I've spent time with clergy. You know, I think an interest in the exterior world. The stuff about the interior world is going to be given to you as it's given to any human being of any sensitivity. So I do find that playwrights who aren't curious, it just seems to me so much what it's about. It's about finding out about difference, about how people think differently from you, not how people think alike from you. And so that joy in discovering difference is, to me, the at the heart of it. And that feeds your imagination, I hope, because you are going to represent people who are not you. And so how can you do that? How can you begin to do that if you're not deeply interested in the workings of people who are not yourself and the structures that they live in and how they conduct themselves professionally? And that deep interest in other people has to be the primary qualification for a playwright, I'd have thought.
Well, now let's turn to the right.
I'm not on the right, actually. But
depends on where you stand.
Thank you very much, for both of you, for a very interesting conversation. And
now,
you,
I'm not sure your microphone is working.
Okay. Look, thank you both very much for a very interesting conversation, and particularly to you, David, for the background in Britain to a lot of your work and your concerns. Your play, Skylark, is about to come on in this theatre very soon, and I was just wondering if you'd like to tell us a little bit about the genesis of this play.
Skylark really came out of the fact that I'd written a trilogy of plays about the church, the law, and then about politics. And it seemed to me that Thatcherism had been put into practice in Britain. And there were a lot of ideologues in 10 Downing Street who were intellectuals and who wanted to put this theory into practice. And what it was creating was immense social breakdown and crack-ups in society. And it was the heroes of my plays became the people who saw themselves as their job to bandage the wounds. I was very surprised the degree to which the police were radicalized. The police I worked with when I was writing a play about them said to me, Thatcher has all these theories, but we are the people who have to clean up the mess created by these theories. I thought, my God, I'm among radical policemen. I never thought I'd see that in my lifetime. But Thatcher had that effect of radicalizing anyone who was in public service. And so with Skylight, I had recently fallen into the world of business and become close to the world of business and among people whose ethic was the business ethic, the retail ethic. And it's just struck me that the country was more and more divided between those two ethics, the business ethic and the public ethic. And I wanted, in a private and personal story, which is a love story, essentially, Skylight, but I wanted to write about the difference of approach between those two cultures, a woman who appears to be almost punishing herself in her desire to put herself in the worst possible situation in society, and a man who, having risen up through society, just wants to get out and away from the poor and the deprived. And so I wanted to write about those two different attitudes, and I hope I wrote them. You know, I'm always pleased with Skylight, where people say that they agree with whoever's spoken last. And that they're always more sympathetic to whoever's spoken last. And I hope that the thing is finally balanced between the two. Though I noticed in recent revivals that the point of view of the woman is more and more strongly applauded in the second act. Certainly when Kerry Mulligan and Bill Nye played it recently in London and New York, then Kerry Mulligan's individual speeches were applauded in the theatre because people feel so strongly that the point of view of public service is no longer represented. And that's really my answer to the Nigel Farndales of the world, which is that if I don't speak for those people, who does speak? Nobody does.
And that seems a perfect note to end on. David Hare, thank you very much.
Thank you, Julie.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.